Do I believe there's a recession coming? Absolutely. Do I believe it'll be a soft landing? Not at all. It's going to be a hard landing.
Welcome to Thoughtful Money. I'm its founder and your host, Adam Taggart. The economy's chugging along at a more robust GDP growth than many expected. Inflation's moderated and unemployment remains low. Many, including Wall Street for certain, have bought into the soft landing or no landing at all narrative. We're in a Goldilocks era, they tell us. Bears should just stop worrying, admit they've been wrong, and join the party. So, is that truly the case? For answers, we turn to market analyst Gordon Long of Matassi, Macro Analytics and Technical Analysis Strategic Investment Insight. Gordon, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Always enjoy these discussions.
Oh, I do too. And Gordon, you have become an audience favorite. So great to have you here on Thoughtful Money. Look, lots to talk about, and you were very kind to put together a number of slides, which we'll get to in just a moment about sort of how you see the world right now. Very quickly, though, if we can just kick it off at the question I like to ask at the beginning of all of these interviews, which is, what is your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets?
Good question. Big question. Is that in 25 words or less?
Now take as many words as you want.
Okay. Actually, two parts to that. Global are the economy and markets, and they're not the same answer because they are disconnected in a way that we haven't had in or have been increasingly going to in years. But so economics and markets, but let me start with the economy, and that has actually two parts, globally and the U.S., and they're different. Right now, we have a pretty, some of the charts economically, and if you really get into the details, the economy has never been shakier with underlying issues associated. It all stems back to the level of debt, the ability to finance the debt, the sort of risk premiums that are going into, that should be in the debt. Duration risk on the bond market, equity risk premiums on the equity side of the house. But having said that, right now we're actually seeing an upturn, an upswing in the global economy, and maybe even more so in the United States. And that's coming because the financial conditions index, as an example, have weakened so dramatically since last fall. And there is so much liquidity out there. And by the way, we need to talk about the stealth liquidity that's actually being put out into the market. So we've got this upswing. So from an economic standpoint, it looks pretty good, likely being an election year, and the amount of elections that are being run around the world, they're all going to push a little bit of extra programs and push into the economy to get elected. We always see that. So on the surface, the economy should hold up fairly well through the course of this year. Do I believe there's a recession coming? Absolutely. Do I believe it'll be a soft landing? Not at all. It's going to be a hard landing. It's going to be longer getting to us than I originally thought, personally. I will start to see movements of that, of unfolding of that recession later in the fall and into next year. Don't get me wrong. That's because of the numbers. They're actually, if you look at the unemployment numbers, they're much worse than are being reported. The jobless claims this morning, they're almost a joke. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, even the Fed is questioning their numbers in the FOMC. I don't want to get into that. Just put it off to the side. But they can only cover that for so long before it breaks into the open, and that's why it'll drift. We'll really see it in the fall. But on the market, on the market side of it, we're right on a cusp of whether it's going to break at any given time. And I mean, with the liquidity, it says it should hold the market up. And I guess the best way of describing it is that, you know, market tops are a process. They take and we're in something that is really, I believe, is generational. This is not this decade. Though I think we're going to be correcting the COVID and the run-up we've had since 2008 through the process of financial correction that's coming over the next few years, what I call the beta drought decade, where we see more stagnation and then stagflation. Eventually, that's longer ways out. But it takes a couple years to actually fill in that top and a dome top and double tops. That's kind of what we're in right now. But on the other, they always say that bottoms are an event, but tops are a process, and it's dragging it out. So the markets itself, and just to comment on it, there's so many things that could trigger, whether it's a commercial real estate crisis, a banking crisis. There are so many areas that could trigger it at any time and have a fairly significant correction. But there's so much, I'll just wrap it up. There's so much MOMO and FOMO out there, momentum and fear of missing out. And we've conditioned at least one generation, maybe two generations of buying the dips. Everybody's a gamma, a trader or a mem trader right now. It takes a number of shocks to shake it out of the market. So I think we may see a shock and breakdown, but it'll bounce back up as we work through it. But it'll finally be that recession that'll take us down. A little long-winded, but we can get into that in more detail.
All right. No, it's great. One of
That
the
makes sense?
things I love No, one of the things I love about you, Gordon, is you're very specific in terms of how you see the world here. This progression you're laying out, certainly has an understandable logic to it. And you've got some gray in your hair there. You've been through several market cycles of the course of your career. And before we turn the camera on here, you were talking about how there was a lot of the gestalt of what you're experiencing right now. It feels very similar to how you felt back during the dot-com bubble and its successes in those later stages, right?
Exactly, very sad. A deja vu. So what it feels like. It's never the same. The old expression, well, markets aren't, but they it rhymes. We've got the same kinds of. I think I sent you a chart on the trifecta. We've got the same elements breaking that we've seen before, and they haven't been. They've been at major events previously. There are so many charts that send signals, but there's only a few that are multi-decade or decade long that really give you good signals. They never give you good timing on them, but it tells you, when you should start to take risk off the table. And we're in such a period right now.
Okay, well, that's getting to one of the punchlines I was going to ask. You're saying for the prudent, concerned investor, you think this is a risk-off period, time to take your chips off the table. So you mentioned your charts.
Depend
Yeah, go
if we're
ahead.
talking equities, okay, absolutely. But there's a lot of markets here we can talk about, whether the bond, the credit market, or the currency markets. And there's a time to be in each one of those and a time to rotate. I think the time to get out of the equity market is now, but I think there's time to be in things such as the bond market and various elements of it.
Okay, great. Well, let's talk about all the markets. And to get there, you mentioned your charts. Let's get to the charts that you prepared for here, because I think that's a great segue in terms of sort of how you're seeing things here.
This is what I called the trifecta earlier, is and we're this is a log chart of the S&P, and what it's measuring is when we've had highs five when we're in a trading range, it's within 5% of a high, of an all-time high, and when that comes and goes. And if you go through the chart, you can see in the orange here when we have these periods. So we're at a really elevated highs. And we've been in it, if you look at the chart, 42% of the time we've been in that since 48. It's been a fantastic period of time for the US economy. But if you start to look at the behavior within it, you see these three boxes. We get back into the 70s, which I lived through that. I was starting my professional career at that point in time. The dot-com bubble and the financial crisis is both in that second box, and then where we are right now, and you can see kind of a pattern in there too between the first two and the possibility of in the third. Now, what are patterns? But what's important is what's inside this pattern, and what we've got in each one of those is extreme narrowing in breadth. And in the 70s, it was the Nifty 50s, for those that might recall it. And then in the dot-com and the financial crisis, we got into, it was the major techs, the internet kind of companies, but it narrowed down. It was, we started to get fewer and fewer. And now were basically in the Magnificent Seven and down even into three, and driven primarily by dominantly recently by Nvidia. We have never seen the breadth narrower, with fewer stocks carrying a dominant part of the market than ever before. And I'm not even talking about the explosion in ETFs that are built into it. So there's this narrowing breadth, which is fine. That's what's consistent here of those three areas. But also, when that breadth starts to drive into a parabolic lift. And in every case, if you track the charts, you'll see they started to move into a parabolic lift. So you've got that set of patterns, which is very, very unique, which is problematic in its nature. But that doesn't mean the market's going to suddenly crash. But the other thing you see is obvious here, is this double highs. And you get this one period, you get this major sell-off, and it's they're over long periods of time. The second box there, the first top is 2000 with the dot-com. The second box, when we came up and double tested, these are M tops or double tops, was really the financial crisis in 2008, and we went down. So, they can be longer or they can be shorter, but it's this retest. It's this getting rid of this buying on the dips, this mentality that gets built into the system. And you get these double highs, double tops, which effectively creates a dome, technically, and you get inside the dome. But so we're starting to build, real unique consistencies in these things, unique but consistent. And the third part of this, which is really important, is that the second peak is there's a recession with it. There is typically with the first one too, but not necessarily, maybe a little leading. But the second one really leads into a major recession and drop. So when you put them all together, all it says is there's a very high probability of something happening, and therefore it's from my standpoint, or as we're investors, time to take the risk off the market in the equity markets. It's too risky. Doesn't mean people aren't going to make money. If you're a speculator or a gambler, man, we have 25% lifts since December. Never been a better time to make money. But I can tell you this, markets go down 8 times faster than they go up. Just remember that.
8 times faster. All right, that's a great stat.
That's my rule.
That's the Gordon Long rule of market action.
Yeah, that's what it tells me in my gut when I go through it.
Okay. All right. Well, look,
I
a
can
couple.
lose money. I lo Look at it this way. I can lose money 8 times faster than I can make it if I'm not. So
Okay.
I have to pay attention to the risk reward. It's not that the reward isn't great right now. It's the risk that goes with it, and it's assessing properly what the risk is. And as I said previously, the risk margin, the equity risk premiums are not big enough right now. Well, they are there. They're not being priced in properly, and that'll change very quickly.
Okay. So let me just make sure I'm interpreting the graph correctly here. So these are M tops, meaning there are two tops, and after the second top, when we have the similar conditions, you get a pretty big market drop and a recession. And it looks like in the upper right box here that we're currently in right now, you are seeing the formation of the peak of the second M, or the
That's correct.
second part of the M, right? Okay.
Oh, the outside strength, technically, because M tops come in all degrees. But yes, we're in the top of the second part of the M, the outside strength.
Okay, which means soon on a relative basis, if this historical relationship holds, we should start the downtrend. We should start the bottoming event that you mentioned earlier. Now, this is a log chart, so if indeed that happens and we follow sort of past trajectories, you could see the S&P getting down to what here, about 2000 or so?
No, not initially anyway. A longer term, it depends on the slope of the line, but certainly we see it going down in stages. Obviously, typically when a market goes down or up in an impulse fashion, if you're an Elliott wave practitioner, it goes in five waves, an impulse, and then corrects in two waves. And the structure in this, we'll tell how it unfolds. We'll tell us really how deep it goes. But the point I'm getting to is the first wave down will correct everything we've had as a lift, and I'm saying probability since the COVID low. That's what we need to correct. And then the next correction after that it starts to unfold, and we think that is in the cards, is a correction that starts to take us down to correct the lift that we've had as we came out of the bottom of the 2008 financial crisis. So then
Okay.
we have the potential to get down there. But that doesn't mean, I refer to them as killing fields. You know, it's going to be a very difficult thing to trade because it'll be quite violent initially before people start really capitulating and throwing in the towel.
Okay, got it. And that's all. Yeah, so great additional detail. So once it starts correcting, it's obviously not going to go down just in a straight line. There'll be some violent jumps and corrections. I was just trying to get a sense
More so
for.
at the beginning, as you change the sentiment and the attitude, and money starts to disappear, because remember, we're so highly leveraged. It's when people start to ha are forced to sell that comes with the capitulation, but that's going to take a while to bleed out. But as that capital is killed, it starts to accelerate. And this time, it may be worse than the previous ones because we've never tested this ETF regime that we put in the last 10 years. And if, for those who remember the 2008, when Paulson and Bernanke headed up to the Hill and they were scared stiff, when it was a Thursday, I recall, of what could happen in the market, because all of the, and at the time, all of the CFOs were going, because we'd broke the buck on at the time on money market funds. And they had, because all the CFOs were going to their computers and were moving their money out overnights into longer into protecting assets. And it was $5 trillion. And it scared the bejesus out of them. And it was correctly. This time, $5 trillion is nothing in comparison to what we have with ETFs. And these are not people on screens that are CFOs just. These are moms and pas who have got their 401 or their IRAs, who suddenly are getting some losses, and they're going to run for the hills at some point. Okay, but it takes a while to go out through that process.
Okay, so a
Tell
couple
me, being a little
quick. Go ahead.
negative, just telling you the worst case.
Yep. No. Don't worry about it. And we've had sort of a similar prediction or cautionary tale told by Michael Green, who spends a lot of time focusing on the net capital inflows, passive inflows to the market. Right. So right now, any additional dollar that gets invested in the market goes disproportionately to a very few number of stocks, right? And that's just because of the algorithms that, and his warning is if those flows ever go negative, you know, we're going to see that effect in reverse, where we'll see those few stocks get hit disproportionately hard. And because they're so widely owned in the markets, and they represent such a big portion of the major indices, they're going to have a disproportionate effect in dragging those down. So don't worry, you're not the only person sort of saying, hey, we should be careful about this.
Well, that's why these patterns resonate, or this particular pattern. If you go to the second slide I had with this one, I'm
I will,
trying to
Gordon, in one
put some
sec.
more meat on it.
I just want to make sure people understand one thing here. This is not a, I'm not saying this is a prediction of yours, but if we get sort of the worst case scenario here, where do you see the S&P having the potential to go down to?
My first stop is 3270 currently. And after that, it could get much worse, as I'm describing. But I can't call that right now.
Okay, I just want to give
The
people a
reason,
sense
reason
of.
you and I wouldn't want to. And the reason is, never ever underestimate what the powers to be will do to the system to try and shore it up. And if you remember, in 2008, I said bottoms are events. What was the event in 2008 that turned that market around? Came out of nowhere. Well, it's very simple for those that were there. The Fed, behind the curtain, without telling anybody in the public market, they moved from mark to market on the derivative structure, which, by the way, is now in measured in the quadrillions. We went from mark to market and took it out, and they could mark it to anything. And a lot of banks were sitting on $84 billion in derivatives. So suddenly they could, so money was suddenly unlimited. So they'll change how we do our accounting or the regulations, and you don't know when will what they will be and when they will change it. Typically, it's historically been they print the money. They may, a lot of banana republics, they'll come in and seize your pension plans to capital them. You'll see capital controls and all those sort of things. Those are the unknowables at this stage. But what is, I believe, very high probability is at least that first wave down that I see down to around 3270.
Okay, great. So, and don't let me put words in your mouth. I just want to make sure folks understand. You're saying you can easily see a correction initially that gets down into the 3200 range
Yes.
that could, if left unaddressed, get a lot worse, but highly unlikely that the central authorities are going to sit on their hands and we could expect anything from them. We've seen a playbook in the 2008 crisis. We've certainly seen them being willing to do more stimulus than anybody ever thought imaginable during COVID. So, it's going to be an uncertain road. Obviously, Gordon, if this starts happening, we'll have you back on and you can give us sort of play-by-play action. Let me just
We
ask
never
this one
had
last one.
quantitative easing, and now it's suddenly a common name. We never had quantitative tightening. We're doing things we've never done before as simply reactionary. And by the way, I mentioned this mark to market. We never put it back on. It was
Right.
never re put back on. So what are we pricing this entire derivative structure, which is on every element of Exeter's pyramid of assets and how you measure asset, real value, tangible wealth. And so, when I say it's on every level, there are elements trading in derivatives on every one of those. We saw that in Britain with the insurance companies in the last spring. It almost brought down the guild, if you recall,
I do.
when it
I
suddenly
do.
broke. So those are the
So,
exposures, and but they will react. They have to react.
okay, and that was
Just
my
don't know
last
how.
question here, which is not knowing what they're going to do, I assume you place a quite high probability that they are going to do something and probably something pretty substantial should that initial shock down to 3200 happen.
Without question.
Okay.
Without question. The
Great.
real question is how effective it'll be and how long it'll last. Because until we fix the debt structure that is now becoming insurmountable, because we've got debt increasing faster than the real growth of the GDP was currently measured as GDP. That's a whole discussion. When debt is growing at a faster rate than you're creating the supposed wealth, it doesn't last. So we're in that boat right now.
So, Gordon,
Really?
I have to try to restrain a chuckle when you say, until we fix the debt issue. Do you think we can fix the debt issue? I mean, is there a path to fixing it that you think is actually realistic? Or is it more sort of until we slam into the debt crisis because we're not going to address the debt proactively?
We'll be forced to do something with it, but it's It'll, we could spend an hour trying to figure out, talk about how they're going to do it. But the debt will force changes in the global financial system. You cannot run, to be really blunt, you cannot run a $650 trillion swaps market that's unregulated, over the counter, with no visibility other than through the global banks. That's what it is. Go to the Bank of International Settlements and look at how many interest and currency swaps are traded around the world, and the book nominal value of that is in the $600 to $700 trillion mark.
My
What's the
goodness.
global economy? Okay, the United States, we're 27, so we're around $86 trillion. Makes no sense. So that's how they're currently holding it together. So why those numbers, just maybe we can add some more zeros and keep it going. We'll try.
Okay, but this is sort of
The
like.
issue, I'm getting a little off track, but the issue, to be blunt, is the problem we face is not the increasing of the debt, it's the increasing of real wealth or collateral. We're not increasing the collateral that underpins all of the lending that's going on, and the collateral is not growing at a fast enough rate. And we use something called rehypothecation, which means moving many, many people claim the asset, but it doesn't. Through novation, they move it around, and nobody seems to understand any of this, believe it or not, except the banks do. The banks understand this in gory, and their lawyers in gory detail. But until they And the reason we aren't growing wealth fast enough, it's all paper. Money and contracts are just paper claims on wealth. And I think the last time I was here, I said to you, the only way you create wealth is you got to grow it, you got to build it, or you got to mine it. You can't print it. And that's the problem. Now, we seem to have forgot what real money is and real wealth is.
All right,
I'm going to get
grow
an
it.
education on that in this decade.
All right. Sorry, we're going to get an education of that in this decade, meaning the repercussions of growing our claims on real things much faster than we're growing the real things themselves. That's going to finally catch up with us.
Yeah, it'll catch up to us. But it doesn't mean the world's going to come to an end. We'll just have to do some major restructuring and changes. They'll actually maybe be blunt. Band-aids will be put on the system until we finally come up with a solution to this. And the solution is we have to understand we have to get back to sound money. You know, when we don't we went to a fiat currency, what in August of 1972, when we got off the when the US got off the gold standard.
71. 71. It
Yes,
was
so I apologize.
few weeks after I was born, yeah.
And so that's when things started to really change. But the big change came in 1980 when Volcker, behind the scenes, we started the international balance of trades. We started accepting credit versus gold transfers that were done through the Bank of International Settlements. Well, that's when everything changed. And that's you, if you look at the charts, when financial assets exploded at the same time, because you could use paper assets to get it. Now, when I say going back to sound money, I'm not saying we're going to go back to a gold standard. Not going to happen in that kind of context. But we're going to go back where we reset the system, where the underpinnings we can all believe in, and we trust it. We trust in them. I mean, it's always been gold and silver, but it doesn't necessarily have to be that. It typically is that because nobody trusts anybody else, and it's the only thing they trust is the history of gold and silver. But if you're forced into it, and again, a little long-winded, but if we're forced into a corner, it's amazing how people start to really get together to solve the problem. And that's probably what's in the horizon.
Okay. All right. I'd love to have a conversation with you at some point, Gordon, about what you think the right solutions should be, and also what investment opportunities might come out of that new era. But we got a lot of road to go before we get to that stage, sadly. I think it's going to take
That's
a
what's
while.
important.
Yeah. So let's get back. Let me help you get back on track here. I put up the second slide. I know we got many more to try to get through here. So I'll try to ask fewer questions and just let you run.
Oh, okay. I wasn't meaning to go through the slide, but so I thought there'd be some whatever you wanted to talk about. But let me run through the ones I did send you. This kind of brings it into perspective of just taking the top 50 at any kind of time. And I went all this going all the way back to the 60s. And there's the Nifty 50 I mentioned earlier over here on the left. And then as even more we and what we're measuring is taking the top 50 stocks. And you can see this getting fewer and fewer. Now we're down to like 0.84 on them. Now, as we were recently down even further. But since the Mag 7 came in and the end of this parabola here, parabolic lift, was really what's happened with artificial intelligence. I think it'll be huge, but I also believe the internet was huge and we were right. But the markets eventually get into reality and price things differently. And that tells you really in one chart what's going on here. And what I found interesting is everything in the market's about rate of change. It's never about absolute numbers. And you notice the peak or the valley and the peak and where we are right now line up perfectly. I thought it was an interesting suggestion on timing that we're pretty close to something abruptly changing because markets work within boundary conditions, and that's what it's telling you. If you go to the next chart, I'm just trying to put in some meat onto what I've been suggesting here. This is a parabola, a parabolic rise that we've had, and I connect at the bottom. You can see here with COVID, and there's the cycles charts on when the cycles that we went through. We've been actually using this chart for quite a few years now, and with a dotted line specifically. And then we saw the COVID had to readjust the line number, but when we saw the vertical line at the next peak on the cycle down, that's that vertical red line. And it was starting to signal, 5180, that sort of thing. We thought it was so absurd, and it had broken down. We just didn't understand how it could happen, but here it is, and it's sure enough, it's climbed up. I'm not suggesting there's anything magic in that 5186. At the end, parabolas are a funny little instrument, and if you get into Elliott waves, they truncate when you these and we may get a truncation much sooner than that. We don't know when it is, but right now, that's the kind of the era that we're in, and it's been very predictive. Want to go to the next chart?
Sure, I will. I just want to note
I
for
ask.
viewers here that you've got the 5186.
There's nothing magic in that. That's just what it measures.
It's not a magic number, but I just want to note that we are only 100 points away from that right now in the S&P. So we are getting close to that number, whatever its meaning turns out to be.
And here's the M top or the dome top, and a measure down with the Fed funds rate here in the chart, and our what we call we have a proprietary measurement for momentum, and we have a major divergence here on the very bottom against this top over a longer period of time. And so even though we have this big movement in this chart, it really puts it into perspective. We're just putting in the M top, the flow over in the red. And the correction that I show, because we think the structure for those that are in Elliott wave will be what they call a double combo corrective Z pattern. I'll just leave it at that, which is a Y, X, and a W down of three structures. And it's been playing out, and they work in fractals all the way down, and the fractals have been working pretty well. They're difficult to measure, but something like that. The point being, the drop gets down to the COVID line on the rising black channel, where we got the lows of the COVID crisis somewhere in there on this kind of corrective, comes up, maybe it tests that dome underline of the black channel. But we think that black channel from the financial crisis is very much a possibility through the course of the next 3 to 5 years. It could be sooner. It could happen very abruptly.
Okay. I just got to ask my regular question because you've got the data here. So you see in the middle of this chart, you've got the Fed funds rate.
Correct.
Just about every other major market drop was preceded by, an aggressive rate hike campaign that then plateaued for a period of time. And then the economy fell into recession and the markets went down with it. And the Fed was more or less chasing all that by trying to quickly cut rates. You could look at that and say, well, if we look at history, that's what we should expect going forward from right about here. But of course, everybody is saying, nope, it's different this time. The lag effects are not going to matter. So I'm just going to ask my regular lag effect question. Have the lag effects been magically dispelled this time around, or do you expect them to come? I mean, you mentioned you think there's going to be a recession at some point in the next year or so. Will that be due to the lag effects finally arriving?
Yes, and the Fed funds rate follows the 2-year Treasury bill without question. It just does. The Fed never leads. Fed follows. It follows the region. The banks. The banks actually tell them what it should be, and then eventually they move on it. And right now the 2-year is quite lower. So we're at a point where the banks are suggesting the answer to your question, that the lag effects are getting very, very close in here to really coming into play. And what's confusing them and confused us for a while is sorting through the real impacts of rate increases, because so many people, ourselves included, took advantage of those low rates and locked in money. Corporations now, a lot of them are net interest. Even though rates are going up, they're making more money on their balance up from the interest rates, because they're protected on having sold bonds. Mortgage. Why is the mortgage market in a position that it's in with used houses? Nobody can move out of their used house because they can't afford to give up that mortgage rate they bought that first house in to go to the second one. So, and I can go on with that. There's just so much of that money has been locked in that increasing the rates just hasn't done the job yet, but it will, and it's slower, and that's what's dragging it out. And part of that too is we also push so much money into the savings people didn't pay rents, they forbearances, etc. That money's starting to dry out. So it's taken a lot longer, but it's going to come.
Okay.
This chart, I like to put some fundamentals in the whole structure, and I'm a big supporter of the work that John Hussman does, who probably tears apart fundamentals better than anybody I've ever witnessed. And he doesn't put out this chart very often. And these are key inflection points where all of his measures, or some of them over here, start to all line up together under basic technical and fundamental analysis. And we're right at that point, right in there where something should happen. And he's been consistently right with his measurements over a longer period of time, which is just a way of saying, if you look at all the other measurements, they're also lining up with it. So if we flip along and just moving along on some of these so everybody can get as big a picture as possible. Another reason it's dragging it out is we've got this oh, that's, I was going to say a fight, but it's actually orchestrated. What the Fed has been doing with the increasing rates, it hasn't been tightening liquidity. It really haven't, even with quantitative tightening. To some degree, and it's because there's games that are being played. Everybody watches Powell. Frankly, we watch Yellen. It's Janet Yellen that's really behind the scenes playing the games right now, and it's through the TGA, the Treasury General Account over here on the right side. And I show two phases here, because what's been going on is, we've been taking money out of the reverse repo market. We had $2.7 trillion sitting there. We've taken it down to $500 billion and even lower. That money went over to the Treasury. Was taken, went into money market funds. It went into short term. And Yellen has been driving out T-bills, not longer duration money. So she's been selling, 1 week, 2 week, 90-day, 6 month kinds of money, and you can see it with that slashed line. And that money turned around and went right out of the economy wherever the government wanted to put it. The government's put through $6.7 trillion in spending, but it's how it's flowing out into the market. I know up here in the Northeast, if you're in a solar business, if you're in a heat pump business, man, they're just everybody everywhere trying to take advantage of of that money that's flowing out. The hiring, the jobs, et cetera. So that's what's been going on since we came out of the debt ceiling discussion last June. What we're in now is the beginnings, is on the bottom of another sophisticated game that we're played through the banks taking advantage of the bank term funding program. The large banks, the big banks, who were then stopped abruptly after they got out about $60 billion that they take out, they've flowed through to money managers, went into hedge funds, that's now ready and able to go longer term to 5 and 7 and longer term duration. So the Fed's, between Janet and the Fed, they're fully loaded to keep this economy in good shape. Well, plenty of liquidity all the way through the election. So, and that's basically what's going on behind the scenes without everybody. Everybody's so scared about foreign investors and the auctions. It'll be fine
Okay,
until
so
its money
this,
runs out.
right, and so appreciate the structure. It's fascinating. We've talked a bit on this
I
program
didn't mean
about
to get
how.
so detailed, but some
No,
listeners probably will.
it's wonderful that you've had, because this has been one of the biggest conundrums for folks, which is that, look, we've been in this quote unquote tightening, hiking and tightening cycle, and yet starting, at October of 2022. All boats have started rising again, and people have been wondering why. And we're supposed to have these lag effects and all this stuff, right? And it's, we've had some speakers on, like Michael Howell, who used to work for Salomon Brothers, who said it's all about net liquidity flows. But it's, everybody sort of has their own measurement of net liquidity, and it's something that's opaque to a lot of regular investors. So what you're doing here is you're really exposing the mechanism by how it's happening here. And basically, your punchline is they can keep, they being the tandem of the Treasury and the Fed, can keep this stealth liquidity going well enough through the election where you're not that worried about there being some sort of dire economic news that could look bad on the current administration getting up to the election, which of course is the goal of any sitting administration coming up to a presidential election. There's nothing unique about this. But you're basically saying they can hold it together until then.
In
It does,
theory.
in theory, it does sound like you think at some point the recessionary forces are going to win out of this, whether just because they get large enough and enough time is allowed, or because the election's over and they take their foot off the accelerator because they don't need it anymore. Don't necessarily know what the trigger is going to be, but you do think at some point, correct me if I'm wrong, probably after the election, probability wise, they hold things together until then, but at some point after, they can't, and those downward forces that you've already shown in the previous slides begin to really take effect.
Yeah, you can only do it so long, but they can come up with another chart, another one. I face stage three in here too. The wild card in it is they don't control the world, nor do they really control anything other than interest and in floating more debt. Things can break. We have the commercial real estate office complex in serious problems right now, and that's going to take the regional banks, and the regional banks are in serious problems. That's not an understatement. If you look at the $600 billion that they've got is this unrealized capital losses, unless they hold it to maturity, and they can't afford those. So we have a whole series of things that are happening that can break this where liquidity doesn't make any difference unless it's completely targeted at the problem, as this BTFP was originally when we first had the banking crisis, starting to show primarily in the smaller banks. And the regional banks. If you flip to the next chart, Adam, you'll see, because you made a statement. It says, that we got freeing up and having a better liquidity and financial conditions are better. They never really did make it tougher. This is the Fed state. This is the Fed sheets from the Fed, the Chicago Financial Conditions Index put out by the St. Louis Fed. The green, it's we've always been. The only thing you see is the slope of the line of whether it's even easier. It's always been easier. It's just the degree of how easy. And that's what's really missing in here. What confuses people is the banks, yes, have tightened their credit, no question. Credit standards have got tighter, but there's enough money and loans that are out there that's the liquidity is just plenty. And that's actually what's currently driving the liquidity, the financial conditions index to get even looser. You see it going down here. Most charts you'll see is expanding dramatically, is because of this phase two, phase one of the stealth liquidity that's being pushed out into the market. But anything can break this at any given time. These guys are not gods, and they're doing the best they can to keep it together. But th we're living the financial system is so complex. And as I said earlier, the derivative structure that's behind all of our markets is unpoliced, it's unregulated, and it's a Wild West show. And things can break very quickly.
So,
They're not
Gordon,
interesting.
former head of the Office for Management and Budget under Reagan, David Stockman, wrote a book, I don't know, 8, 10 years ago, called The Great Deformation, about all of the intervention that was done in the wake of the Great Financial Crisis. And I've always really appreciated that term, deformation, because that really is what is going on. You would otherwise have true price discovery if you just let market forces have their way. But with all this intervention and these different stages and all these efforts to keep things artificially propped up, you begin to deform the system. And what I hear you saying is the more you deform the system, the longer you deform the system, because it's such a complex system and it requires more and more scale of intervention to keep things propped up as time goes on. That when the system does get out of the control of those that are trying to control it, the consequences, the collateral damage is higher. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. That's exactly right. Just gets worse. The longer we keep kicking the can, the bigger the crisis will become, and the more systemic it will become, and more secular it will become longer term. And but we will kick the can and keep doing it. You can always count on the politicians and the political class to throw money at the problem. No matter what they do, they will print the money. They will solve, and they'll point it at whatever problem that they perceive it to be.
Wow.
And that's the world that we live in.
Well,
And
this is.
but you can't kick that can indefinitely. And I don't know when that's going to be. Maybe I'm long and gone before it's finally resolved. You shouldn't stay up nights worrying about that if you're an investor. Know it's there and know how to make money in what you can make money on this year, next year.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go to the next slide because I do want to get soon to the topic of, so how are you positioning given all this the setup that you see here.
Yeah, that one of the things that is going on is we're just misrepresenting the problem, and even in how we're reporting it. You know, we've argued for years that inflation was not what it was. People familiar with John Williams over Shadow Stats when takes it back to what it used, what how inflation CPI was measured in 1980s, 1990s, is dramatically higher than what we currently have because of hedonics, substitution, imputation. There's a whole bunch of strategies that they've used to keep it in. But you know, so even when we look at inflation, it is worse than we report economically. But there's a bigger problem, and we measure everything against GDP. And I've been watching. You know, just as a backup for those that aren't familiar, GDP stands for gross domestic product, gross. And GDI is its sister. They equal each other. Gross domestic income. They're within hair distances of, they're supposed to be exactly the same, but because of reporting, fact gathering data, there's a statistic anomaly. And they've usually tracked very, very closely up until the current administration took power and started this onslaught of $6.7 trillion of increase in the national debt and borrowing the money to do it. I'm not passing judgment on whether that was the right policy strategy. I'm simply saying that the GDP is supposed to equal a GDI. Nobody pays attention to the GDI. And if you look at the, just flip it through, next chart, this shows you the difference. That it's went from supposed to be, it's not supposed to be, it was how the system was designed. It's a double accounting system. And it says they should be exactly equal. And you can see in Q3, we were reporting GDP over here at 1.5%, or a GDI rather. And over on the right, the GDP was showing 5%. Then in Q, but we go back to Q2, was 0.05 and 3%. A comparison, what is going on? And then you can see the year-over-year differences. It is just dramatically larger. So if we're measuring GDP, it should be, you know, what's our debt against our GDP? It should be what's our debt against GDI? And frankly, I believe it should be against our GDI. But nobody, and the reason we got into that years ago, GDPs were created by surveys so we could put out the numbers. GDIs were had to be all, they all come from ledgers, that's before automation. So it was later we got into the habit of looking at GDP. We should be looking at GDI. We go to the next chart to try and make sense out of it. If you look at the GDP, you know, what we're doing was we're measuring value on one side, but we measure it in terms of expenditure. This is the big difference. Expenditure, and these are the elements that are in the GDP. It's about how much money you're spending and where you're spending. And that expenditure money should be the same as what the right side, which is GDI, which is really measuring what the income is. So somebody spends the money, they're spending it. That's an expenditure. Somebody else is getting it, whether it's a person, it's a company, somebody else gets it, it's income. They have to equal, or they should be exactly equal in a closed, more or less closed economy. And so what's happening with inflation, you're seeing a complete different performance on one side than on the other on each of these line items. But more importantly, the amount of money that we're pushing into the economy is really distorted. So we're not creating wealth. We look at GDP and we say it's value. It's not value anymore. It's really just money because we're borrowing the money and it's debt. It's creating some level of income, but it's on transfer payments. So we have government, I'm being just trying that out. We borrow money from foreigners. In the GDP formula, that's called I, it's investment, so it's added there. The government's got it, they spend it. That's called government spending. We say, there it is again. Then they give it as transfer payments to the consumer. We're a 70% consumption economy, all sorts of transfers from Social Security, Medicare, disabilities, et cetera. They spend it. We call it consumption, and we say economy's good. Except when you look at the GDI, it says, I don't think so here. And that's what that in a nutshell is really what the problem is. And so if you go to
Okay,
the next, oh,
so
sorry.
real quick, the lower GDI numbers are basically indicating that the economy is weaker than we're being told by the folks looking at the GDP numbers. I just want to marry that to the Fed has, basically two mandates, right? Price stability and maximum employment. We look at the low unemployment rates.
And a third, keep the government financed.
And keep the government financed. Okay, which clearly seems
Exactly.
priority number one to them.
Well, it's the number one priority.
But looking at the unemployment numbers as well, and you gave a nod to this earlier, I don't know if anybody believes them anymore. I mean, even the Fed in their latest minutes made a comment about, like, we're seeing some disparity that we're not sure if, these numbers should be taken at their face value. So literally nobody kind of believes them anymore. So I just want to underscore, like, you talked about how complex the system is, how we have these massive derivative overhangs and whatnot, just this massive complex tangle. And we've got humans trying to navigate their way through it. And are they navigating their way through it actually using faulty instrumentation if they're looking at the GDP and they're looking at the BLS reported unemployment stats and those type of what might be sort of erroneous or doctored stats?
Yes, they are. They are. The central banks are not naive to anything I've just said here, but they work in a political environment where they have to, a lot of CEOs aren't economists. And so they have to explain things in a way that they understand and see in the realities. But underneath it, they also understand the real value of money and what they have to do. But they're restricted in what they can do. And remember, even who's appointed now to control the boards of the things like the FOMC, they're political appointments. And
Well,
so they
and to that
different
point,
views.
the Capitol Hill people, you know better than I, but my assessment of their economic understanding is I rate it pretty low. Would you agree?
There's a lot of talented people in the central banks who really know it, but they're time they get the information gets starts to lift up to the board and the decision makers, it becomes a political set of decisions. And I can so
Right. Well, then on the fiscal side, I mean, I'm talking more about Congress and whatnot. I mean,
I was talking about the monetary side on
right,
the Federal
which I assume
Reserve.
is a bit smarter on these
On the
topics.
politicians, they haven't got a clue.
Yeah.
I
And
mean,
that
they're bright people. I don't mean to be critical. They're bright people, but they're not, they don't understand any of this, nor are they interested in doing it. Interested. I had a friend of mine actually make a present, Richard Duncan, made a presentation to them here not long ago based on his book. And Richard spent more time explaining to them basic economics. So
economics, right? And that one of the reasons why I raise this is what's sort of different this time is in the past certainly after coming out of 2008, it was the monetary side that did the majority of the lifting, but now we have a huge fiscal stimulus, ongoing fiscal stimulus component, and that is more controlled by people that have much more political than economic agendas.
totally political agendas, as they rightly should be in many regards, but it's the questions of the political priorities that they have, and a lot and there's a lot of questions of what their priorities should be or are right now. And that's a whole other discussion on it. But this is the chart I'd mentioned earlier with the growth of the national debt versus GDP. And as bad as it looks against the GDP, we're just in a discussion of whether even that's valid. And you can't run an economy and sustain it very long when this starts to happen. These are
No.
not my numbers. These are the federal government's, and this is this formula I mentioned. Where because one of the big issues is we're no longer in the United States an industrial country the way we were. Therefore, exports and imports have changed so dramatically. That is the things that pay our bills, and we're a service economy, which is fine. But really, we're just moving the money amongst ourselves. And as long as we don't buy anything, we're fine. But if we have to buy something and pay for it, like Japanese electronics or whatever, money goes out of the country. So we're importing cash into that eye there, and then we're pumping it around in our formula. And I mentioned that the issues with it. It just creates a lot of distortion. It creates huge amounts of distortion, and that's obviously a problem we've just been discussing. This chart is makes it easier for us to really understand, and goes back to the previous tops that I've showed you. You can see at the top here, this is the yield curve here, that we're showing the dot-com, the financial crisis, and the current situation we're in. And then below it, we mirror in what actually happened with the markets. And then at the bottom, what's happened with our measurements on momentum. And you can see the yellow areas, the pink areas, where they react differently. But they all react the same way. If you go to the top, or you go through them, they all mirror each other. And so over here on the right, COVID really distorted the timing in that, as I said earlier. But right now, our projection is that little dotted line of when the yield curve finally starts to revert, and we're starting to see that climb back up. That's actually, if you look down, when the market starts to really crash, really starts to go down. It doesn't go down sooner than that. So, that's a projection of when we see it, and there's more behind this. And that chart suggests maybe it's the spring when it finally starts to revert here. Or July, that's when we go into the pink area from the yellow area on that inversion. But that's what we watch very closely, and why we're primarily involved in the bond market right now, and in that element of it, and not in the equity markets, because this is a little bit more predictable for us with a better risk return. I
Okay.
don't want to spend any more time on it. So there's a lot of this. There's a whole session on just that here.
Okay. Let me ask one quick question, and I'll go to the next slide as we do that. But you talked about how the Fed and the Treasury working in cahoots, stage one, stage two, can keep the economy likely duct taped together through the election, where the wheels don't come off. Now the economy and the markets are two different things, although sometimes they do get very correlated. Do you see a potential that the markets could behave differently than the economy this year?
Yeah, I do. I do.
Okay,
There
and I guess
is
a time.
a very strong possibility of that.
All right, and it, just a tack on question, because I want to let you explain further, but is how motivated is the existing power structure to keep the markets elevated as well through the elections, just trying to keep everything look rosy, keeping everything look rosy for everybody.
Never been higher incentive to do that.
But you think, but it sounds like you think the markets still could get out of their grasp.
I do. That could happen very, very easily. But they're doing everything they can to, and they've got a lot of money to be able to look what happened with the banking crisis, how quickly they reacted. They're not naive to the problems. They're not naive at all. And they're looking at everything and what they can do with what facilities they need to bring to bear. Remember, during the dot-com, we had 12 facilities, but it took them a while to unload them. I don't think it'll be that long. They'll be very quick, and some of them they'll do without even telling us, to keep this thing going. What we got going is, like you said, cohorts here between the Fed and the monetary and the fiscal policy. We've got the Fed playing a pivot game, and us all focused on the Fed pivot. We know it's coming. It's not coming as fast as people think, but it's coming. But on the other side, we got what I call the Treasury put. And I love this chart because it actually uses that terminology, and that's what's going on. And that's what we're just describing is the put, where the Treasury, not the Fed, the Treasury will take the money that's coming out of the TGA and target it, because they're targeting wherever they want. you read the bills, the Inflation Reduction Act, they can spend the money under the Congress almost with an open checkbook. They're not, it doesn't detail it down at all. So they can point, and they have other things. They have a $86 billion fund just for market stability. I think people refer to it as a plunge protection team, but which is a formal structure to target areas. So they can keep it under wraps. A bigger concern, and this chart's really leading to it, is the, and it's a big point, but it's the, we're in a bond market, but the concern is with currencies right now. The dollar's been really strong, and rightly so. Not a flight to safety, but compared to the situations in Japan, the EU, China, we're the best looking economy in the world right now on the surface, as bad as I Nate made these comments. But the issue is in the currencies. And what can happen with the dollar here is the pivot will not be good for the dollar, because real rates, Yellen has been pushing out tips right now, and buying them, which has been pushing up the rate and driving down the price. That's what she's issuing, if you look underneath it, which is helping real rates climb. And the higher the real rates, the more attractive we are. Not, don't ever look at nominal, always look at the real rates. Unfortunately, they're going to start to turn. And when those real rates start to fall, the dollar will start to weaken. And so that's the bigger issue. And I didn't say the dollar's going to collapse or anything, just weakness. It'll resume the drop we've had from a couple of years ago. We've consolidated. And so we see the dollar starting to weaken. And that's the thing that they want to manage, that drop that's ensuing. And this chart is really showing you that it's really ready to go, because just the dollar moves with the deficits. It moves with deficit spending, trade rated averages and trade balances. It moves with what's happening with the real yields, and all of those are saying dollar correction has got to start to begin. By the way, that's good for the equity markets, because when the dollar cheapens, it makes US stocks more attractive. And it could be a game they want to weaken the dollar even to shore up the markets as we get into the election. Don't want to speculate, just telling you something we're watching.
Okay. I think this is the last chart we have here.
Yeah, to put it into perspective, this is something that I get quite upset about when people say, well, inflation's behind us. It isn't behind us. It's still in front of us. What we did is we fixed the COVID supply chain shock that hit it, and at the same time, the amount of money we overreacted and needlessly put into the economy. And we've mucked through that with the shock that we've created, and we'll be sorting that out. But we went through three waves in the 70s, and it took us 10 years. I'm not saying there's three waves, but we have another stage here. We have m a massive energy problem. And I'm not talking about just fossil fuels. I'm talking about electricity generation, because what we're doing with coal, that's global, and the amount of money we're investing, we're going to have energy appreciation. What we're doing with our food stocks right now is a major concern. I was just reading the other day, our beef herds are down by 2%, because and a farmer's bills are up, are with the Inflation Reduction Act, are up by $1,300 a farm. So these are on all their balance sheet, these are getting hit hard. So there's a real consolidation happening in the food industry. Meanwhile, we have a bigger and bigger demand and for it. So I think we're going to see a scarcity. And as part of that's deglobalization and de-risking that's happening too within the supply chains. And then shelter's another problem. But we have waves here, and eventually the currency's weakness are really going to start to show. So and you can see this is out over the what I call the beta drought decade. So I think that be careful with your expectations on inflation.
All right. So, Gordon, phenomenal walk through all that amazing data. A
I
lot of
thought we were
people.
going to pick two charts out of this.
No, you put them all together. I thought it was great.
I apologize to our listeners who are still with us for me taking you through all that.
Gordon, look, if there's one thing I know from the viewers here is they appreciate data. So don't worry. You were feeding them exactly the meal that they wanted to eat. So now we get to the key question here in the last couple of minutes, which is how to navigate all this, right? A lot of cross currents, a lot of efforts by the status quo to kind of keep things patched up for as long as they can. You think eventually they're going to lose control. What I pieced together from my notes so far, and why don't you just detail out, but I hear you saying it's time to, be defensive on equities, so risk off on the equity side of things, plan for the dollar to weaken relative to other currencies, maybe a good time for bonds. What do you have to add beyond those notes?
Credit markets, or you can invest in credit markets rather than just bonds and corporate instruments. But that is kind of the scenario that that we're looking at. We right now, we're more or less not in the equity market, and nor are we on inputs in it at all. We kind of see that as something that we'll spend a lot more time on as we drift into Q3, into the July timeframe, into September. Right now, we've been primarily focused in the bond, have been focused in the bond market, and it's been doing really well. We've taken profits and have moved into laddered treasury instruments because we think that there's still a little lift in here. But let me, before it's the pivot itself starts to generate capital gains, never mind being at a fairly good yield. But I'm saying that is, though we've been in the bond market, still playing the bond market. We're now starting to real not are starting to move where we know we're going to have to protect the bond market earnings through currency, the U.S. dollar weakening. So trying to hedge our losses or our gains rather on bonds that we'll get with currency depreciation or devaluation. So the point being, bonds, currency, then I see equities as this starts to unfold. The bigger comment to your listeners is, I do this for a living and have for a lot of years, and it's tough. It's really, if you do not have a professional advisor who really understands this, you're going to be a chattel to this game. This is a very, very tough game. Place get a good investor and stop. Don't be a speculator. Don't be a gambler. Try and get back to solid investing. I don't mean to preach. I just caution our listeners to it's so easy to get greedy. But this is when, again, greed, I think that old Adam, that old expression, bears make money, bulls make money, pigs get slaughtered. And this is when this adage really rings home. But that's so those are the primary instruments. I actually see a lot of investments that are outside the financial markets are in, I'll call it just private equity, small businesses that are going to do well, that need funding, can't get it through the bank, or looking for money to handle cash flows. There's a lot of those that are suffering the problems with the small banks right now and credit unions who want to lend it to them. They've had relate but can't lend it to them. And there's investments there of all sizes.
That's super interesting. Gordon, maybe next time we have you on, we can dig a little bit more deeply into that, because
It's a
people are
very
always
lucrative
looking
market. It's a very lucrative market right now.
for. Okay. I presume you really need to know what you're doing, though, correct?
Well, at least try and know what you're doing. There are days where we don't even know. But
All right. Well, I really appreciate you underscoring, well, two things. One, don't be a gambler. And I have a sense from your comments at the very beginning about how MOMO and FOMO are driving so much of the equity markets right now, that you're really putting a finger on that, which is to say, hey, look, we're probably in late stage, irrational exuberance right now in equities. So don't fight the emotional resistance to get sucked up in that, because I think they're the average retail investor, it's hard for them to resist that siren song when they see their neighbors making a ton of money overnight. I also very much appreciate your
remember
point.
that the neighbors are bragging when they make their money, but when they lose, you never hear from them.
You never hear it, yeah. Until the moving van shows up and you see they have to leave, sadly.
Exactly.
But I also really appreciate your point there about the financial advisors and regular watchers of this program. Hear me say that every week, that for the vast majority of people, especially given markets that are a market environment that's challenging, if you don't have a ton of experience being a successful, DIY investor yourself, recruit the help of a good professional advisor. And you've just helped me make that pitch for the guys from New Harbor Financial who are going to come on in just a few minutes here. So anyways, Gordon, thank you so much. It's always so wonderful to have you on here. Anytime your models tell you, hey, we're entering a new phase, please let me know, and you are welcome to come back on this program and let the audience know about that. Two last quick questions for you. One is, for folks that have really enjoyed this discussion and would like to follow you and your work, where should they go?
Matassi.com, MATASII.com. They exclusively handle anything that I write. I got roped in years ago to writing a newsletter to explain ideas, and it led to one thing to another. So it's available, it's free for charts and everything else to go with it. We charge a minimal subscriber fee. I really recommend it. You just have a look at it and you can decide from there.
It's a great newsletter, and folks, if you paid attention with those charts, you know exactly the type of thing you're going to get. I subscribe to it. It's a wonderful newsletter. All right, Gordon, and then last question is one I've been asking our guests recently. I don't think I've had the chance to ask you it yet on camera. We've been talking all about money and financial investing in this discussion. What's one non-money related investment that you would encourage people to consider adopting in their lives?
I don't know if I'd call it an investment other than an investment in yourself. And that is what I'll call self-reliance. Never before have I, people have got so accustomed to listening to what they're being told through the media, through any sources that are people that are apparently experts. And that it really calls into questions a lot of whether you are getting good data, but not about that as much as yourself. You've really got to become more self-reliant on what you want, following what you believe, as opposed to following what's the narrative or standards that are being pushed at you right now. It gets into simple things like materialism and whether you should be taking on more debt or you should be creating more savings, because savings rates are just plummeting in this country as credit is going through the roof. Is that the right thing for you and your lifestyle? So this focus on who you are, what your moral compass is, and your and therefore I'll call it just self-reliance, is so important. Everybody says, oh yeah, but they tend to just follow the herd. This is not the time to follow the herd potentially over a cliff. So, and that takes some real soul search. It's tough to be self-reliant when somebody else is bragging about all the money they made. But if you don't have that, you're gonna be in that slaughterhouse.
That's great. The old if you don't stand for something, if you don't know what you stand for, you'll fall for anything, right?
Exactly.
So wonderful point. I agree with you 100%. And just to give a nod to the work of a mutual friend of yours and mine, Gordon, Charles Hugh Smith writes a lot about self-reliance. In fact, I think the title of his latest book was Self-Reliance, and highly recommend if folks are interested in learning more about that topic. Go over to Charles's website and check out the book.
And to Matassi, because Charles and I have actually been doing videos on exactly this subject.
Oh, absolutely. All right. Well, so Gordon, when I edit this, I'll put up the link, the URL to Matassi clearly on the screen. Folks will also put links to it in the description of the video below. Highly recommend folks go and listen to those podcasts. So two great minds in conversation together. Gordon, always a pleasure, my friend. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Look forward to talking again.
Well, all right. Well, now's the time of the program where we bring in the lead partners from New Harbor Financial, one of the endorsed financial advisory firms by Thoughtful Money, to both give their reaction to the discussion with Gordon, but also tell us anything notable that's been going on in the markets over the past week. I'm joined, as usual, by lead partners Michael Preston and John Lodra. John, let's start with you. What was your reaction to Gordon's discussion there?
Hi, Adam. Great to be with you again, and great to hear Gordon's chat. What a really enjoyable talk that was you had with him. And I don't say that just because he's a fellow Massachusetts resident. We had a good chance to connect with him offline with you before the recording here today, and we hope to be able to bump into him in our home state. But look, we agree with a lot of his take on things. He did a really, I think, very good job exploring the macro and realities of the situation with a humility that I think is really important, because there's a lot of, and we've been guilty, I suppose, sometimes of lacking some humility ourselves. There are plenty of reasons why these markets are absolutely just disjointed from reality. But there also is an unprecedented degree of extremism on both monetary and fiscal policy that we can't ignore in terms of trying to keep the ship together. So we need to make accommodations for that. And I think he nicely did in his talk. He made the point that has been the theme of the last couple of years, at least, anyways, of how narrow the stock market has been, and he paralleled it to two other major bubble top episodes in history: the 70s with the Nifty 50 and the 2000 tech bubble. We are in a very similarly narrow market. We have the Mag 7, which has now become the Mag 5 or maybe 4, with some of the high flyers starting to falter. Tesla, Apple's been weak, so it's a narrowing among those generals, if you will. To be fair, off the bounce of the October low of last year, we saw a broadening out. We saw things like mid caps and even like the equal weight S&P 500 start to outperform on a relative basis. That quickly, as the market started to reassess rate drop odds for this year, that quickly tilted back in favor of these really concentrated Mag 7 and momentum. If you look at factors, there's a whole kind of battery of, you can look at different kinds of factors: dividend stocks, low volatility stocks, value stocks, growth. The single factor that is year to date heads and shoulders above the rest is momentum factor. If you look at the momentum factor screen, if you will, it's about 17% up year to date versus even the cap weighted S&P is up like 6.5, I think. The equal weight S&P is up a little less than 3. Russell 2000 just went positive on the year. And we have seen a breakout of sorts in the Russell 2000. It took out a multi-month point of resistance. So we are seeing some broadening, but still it is a very narrow market. He talked about an S&P target eventually. So he talked about, he thinks that we're in a kind of an M top, a double top, if you will, in the markets that probably will look similar to the 70s and the 2000 peak. He was, I think, reluctant, but was willing to point out perhaps a downside target of 3270, I think he said, which is about a 36% decline. I think he really, and he certainly was not bashful about saying it, he thinks they should go a lot lower than there, but the policymakers will step in. We totally agree with that. Fair value is certainly way below 3270 if you look at historical metrics. He talked about the Treasury put, which has taken the place of the Fed put. Absolutely couldn't agree more. The fiscal side, fiscal dominance. I know Lynn Alden, for example, who you've had on your channel, has talked about maybe an era of fiscal dominance. And I think that's one area that perhaps we think will create a little bit of a more of a headwind for the bond market than perhaps some people think. Just recently, we've seen several Treasury auctions really not look really good. Bid to cover is not good. Tails really looking quite ugly, to use a flavorful word. And as the Treasury has telegraphed that they're going to start to shift from bills issuance to longer term coupon issuance, we do think that will create a more of a headwind longer term for bonds than perhaps this slam dunk bonds are a great buy. We're getting in the area where we do think increasing our allocation to longer term bonds makes sense. Maybe if we see somewhere close to 4.5 on the 10-year Treasury, that would be an area that we'd want to add a little bit more to our very modest position in longer term bonds. But we're definitely still overweight the short term Treasury part of the bond curve. So those are my big picture takeaways. Really, really like his humility and zooming out. Oh, and one thing, I want to give him props to pointing the real bottom in the market in 2009 wasn't the Fed cutting interest rates or that values had gotten to screamingly low must buy. It was the Fed secretly, essentially going out there and removing the mark-to-market rules and essentially in one fell stroke of the pen rescued the system. So that's just an emblematic example of the extremes they'll go to essentially rewrite the books to try to save the system. And that's something we as money managers have to be cognizant of, that they can't maybe stop everything from falling apart, but there is a line in the sand where the kitchen sink will be thrown at it.
Yeah, and I think that's what's so challenging in this environment to fundamental investors, right? Is I would almost make the claim It's maybe rarely been easier to sort of see the arc of where things will head, given the status quo continuing. But the problem is, as you know, the status quo isn't going to continue, that the rule book is going to get rewritten along the way, like you said, right? So it's you got a position for what is likely to happen based on the math, but then you have to have part of your brain ready to react in real time to whatever the rule changes are going to be. Yeah, you're nodding as I'm saying this, John.
Yep, exactly right, Adam.
Yeah. All right. Well, Mike, how about you? What else would you add to John's commentary there?
Oh boy, there's so much here that I want to say. There's a lot in that talk, and a lot of times that I was listening to Gordon there, I thought I was listening to ourselves. I think that he's a disciple of some of the same things that we are and have been for so long.
Yeah,
You
well,
know, and
certainly with
it
Hussman there.
absolutely, he mentioned Hussman. In fact, since you mentioned it, I'll go there first. He put a chart out that said the S&P is in a parabola, and then he also put that chart out that John Hussman just did in his interim comment the other day. It talked about the set of conditions being very extreme. You really can't predict the timing, and you can't say for sure that something bad's going to happen or the market will drop. But Hussman's chart showed the extreme set of circumstances that are very rare, real. Gordon talked about the market being in a parabola. This has been very difficult because if you remember that chart, there were several parabolas there, but this market's been in a parabola for close to 15 years, right? And it's tried to correct. And I could even argue it's been more than 15 years. And every single time it's tried to correct, it's been rescued with yet another magic trick, another rabbit pulled out of the hat by the Federal Reserve. And so to be a prudent, discerning investor has been really, really tough, really tough. And if you're a disciple of math, it's been really tough. And some things haven't made sense. The whole bubble in meme stocks hasn't made sense. The bubble in crypto didn't make sense, although crypto certainly looks like it's here to stay, and we give respect to it. And you know, Bitcoin, it looks like it's going to make an all-time high. But so many things, we haven't known what's real and what's not real because of the fact that money has been printed out of thin air. And if Gordon talked about these people aren't gods, you know, they're not gods. They're not flawless. They may think so. You know, I don't know what they think, frankly, but they're not gods, just like Gordon said. And things can break. And when things break, the consequences can be a lot worse than you think they're going to be. You can't take a system and push it to the edge of reality like we've seen here and like we've been living through for this long. And the hard part about it is if you look back at that chart of the parabola, you just don't know when it's going to end. And if you're not in it, you feel terrible. You know, so we have, you know, we've adapted some over the years. And so we're participating some. We're up to about 40% notional stocks. But we always have to keep our eye on the ball and realize that this is a crash-prone market. And we're always thinking, well, shoot, if this thing crashes, what's our exposure? What's our plan? What kind of hedges do we have in? We have hedges that we showed in previous videos. I'm happy to show them again today if you want. We keep moving the hedges up with the market. And I'll be the first to say that this market probably goes a little higher. We're sitting here just under the all-time high. Market's up around 16, 17 S&P points today. Over the last week and a half, 2 weeks, it's tried to pull back a little, very reluctantly. There's been some pockets where some stocks have sold off. Last week, Palo Alto Networks. Today, Snowflake is off 30%, 25%. So some of these leading stocks are starting to implode, but still, the vast majority of them are charging higher. So this market hasn't given up. So that's the point. We don't know when the parabola will end. Nobody does. But they've pushed so far that things are likely to break, and they're not gods. And this is the cost. There's a moment of equilibrium and a moment of justice coming. I know it. I don't know when. I think it's this year. And we have to be on guard for it. So Gordon's absolutely right to be out of equities, in our opinion. You know, he said he's basically out of equities and he's making some plays in the bond market. We're doing the same, although we're up to, like I said, closer to 40% equities with our hedges, that we will have to accept a couple percent loss if we get some kind of mini crash. And but nobody knows how that's going to happen. It could be a slow decline. It could be a crash all at once. We've got the hedges in place to take care of that and to layer into the market and get more aggressive as we see lower prices, hopefully over the next year or two. I don't think there's going to be any rush to get in. So I think that's about, those are the things that I saw. And he's absolutely singing our tune about criticizing the Federal Reserve. I'm sorry. but that's the truth of it. History says that these things don't end well.
Well, so great recap. I want to go back to something I asked Gordon right at the beginning of the discussion, which was, hey, Gordon, you've seen a number of market cycles, and this one, you know, he was telling us before the camera got rolling that this felt very similar to when he was managing capital during the dot-com boom. And he had the wherewithal, which he said was really, really difficult at the time, was to he had ridden up the boom pretty well, but had the wherewithal to get out in late 99 or 2000, early 2000, and said he was just taking heaps of abuse from a lot of his investors for missing the continued run-up that was going on in the market, just felt like a punching bag, you know, for a period of time. Then, of course, the bubble burst, and everybody was singing his praises and thanking him for having the fortitude to do that. But it just shows how incredibly hard it is to make these gains in a market like this and then keep them, right? Because most of his peers held on, the market burst. They then got into that trap of bargaining, well, we'll just hold on until things come back up enough, right? And then it never happened, right? So I want to underscore that, because if it's hard for a capital manager like him or professional managers like you to be navigating this, super hard for the average retail investor who's just trying to figure this out on their own, right? And I want to share this headline here from Zero Hedge, which is that investors are finding it increasingly pointless to be bearish, right? This is like a classic headline that you see at a market, near a market peak, right? It's just where you see capitulations at market extremes, right? And it seems like we're at the point of capitulation for the vast majority of whatever remaining bears were left, right? I think Gordon did a really good job of saying, hey, look, if we look at the data, there's a whole bunch of reasons that we need to be skeptical of those that are selling the Goldilocks and it's gonna be forever sunshine and rainbows from here on out. But there's an increasing number of investors who are just saying, look, I had concerns. I looked at the fundamentals. I looked at all these other things that you guys have talked about and have, you know, it's just been beating me up portfolio-wise because none of this stuff is mattering, right? So, John, I'll hand it back to you because I figure that that's got to be something that a number of viewers here are saying, hey, look, I've watched a lot of your guys' videos on this channel. I read a lot of other people who have similarly waived reasons to be concerned about where we are, but man, my idiot brother-in-law just keeps telling me about all the money he's made in NVIDIA this week, and I'm feeling like a heel. And yeah, maybe things are different this time.
Yeah, Adam, bubbles are incredibly hard, and they're not hard because of intellect or anything like that. They're hard because of psychology. Look at the famous story about Sir Isaac Newton having the foresight to get out of the South Sea Trading Company stock, only to get back into it because you couldn't stand that it rose up multiple times.
Basically, because his friends were getting rich. Yeah,
exactly. And he lost it all, right? So it's not about intellect. It's not about smarts. It's all about psychology. And, you know, I think about folks like Jeremy Grantham, legendary cycle investor. He relates how his firm basically was getting criticized in the late 90s for getting out of the tech bubble too early. And of course, early wasn't wrong. It was just early. And here's where, as managers of people's real money, our clients don't get a do-over. Our role as psychological counselors is probably more important than anything we do in these kinds of phases, because ultimately, it's that psychology that tempts people to want to do the wrong thing. And we're human. We all have that. And the only reason we're able to somewhat keep our wits about us is because we ground ourselves in the data and the historical lessons that we can study and learn. And know from history that, hey, it's never the same, but there's all these timeless lessons that keep on getting crammed into our psyche. For us, it really comes down to our clients and why are they investing in the first place? It's not to win some competition. It's to provide the funds they need to survive for hopefully their lifetime comfortably without stress. And these kinds of episodes, playing in them, they may feel good if you can ride, but it's actually the point that it's most important not to play in them in a big way, because that's where sound retirements can absolutely get devastated. We have our own YouTube channel that we try to speak to our clients and folks from the standpoint of what it means to be a client and what are the important things. I just dropped a video this week on retirement income planning and the common risks and pitfalls that we see all the time. And you know, perhaps viewers want to take a look at that because it really emphasizes that, hey, you're not retiring for a year or 3 years. You're retiring hopefully for 20, 30, 40 years. And trust me, missing out on a 10% late stage bubble advance has no bearing on your financial success for the long term. But the flip side of these parabolic moves are historically devastating. If you're unlucky enough, if you aren't in that video I just mentioned, if you are unlucky enough to retire in the year 2000 and followed a traditional investment program, you would have got decimated because the market lost value over the, you know, actually lost money over the subsequent decade. When you retire can be the most unlucky point in your financial planning, and recognizing that when valuations are rich and returns are likely to be disappointing, even negative for a substantial period of time, it makes all the difference to play it safe and know that things will come back to more compelling valuations that are constructive to help grow those assets so they can sustain your lifetime. The stakes are really high right now. We don't ever forget that in terms of what matters to our clients.
I appreciate that, John. And you know, it goes to what Gordon was saying, which is, you know, at the end of the day, it's all about value, like you were talking about, right? And Gordon just says, yeah, we have to look at it in terms of risk and return, right? Can equities go higher from here? Yeah, absolutely. Right. There's probably still some octane left in that tank. It's the associated risk that comes along with it that he's saying, my firm just says, we don't think it's worth it, which is why we're getting out. Right. And you're just saying more or less the same thing. Right. Especially for those that don't have a long investing horizon left ahead of them. Right. Their money needs to last them well the rest of their lives because they've retired and stopped working. So the key thing is to look around right now and say, okay, where does the risk reward make more sense? And Gordon explained why he thinks it's in the bonds market, and it's a big part of your guys' positioning, as you said. All right, well, look, I want to wrap it up here. Mike, I'm going to give you the last word real quickly before I do. Just want to remind folks, because this is where all my focus is now when I'm not on camera, is preparing for the upcoming Thoughtful Money online conference on Saturday, March 16th, which is coming up like a freight train now. If you're watching this today, this video is getting released. You have sadly, if you haven't already registered, you've sadly just missed the expiry for the lowest early bird price discount. But there's still good news. For the remainder of this week, we have our last chance to save price out there before tickets will then jump up to the full ticket price for the final week. So if you're kicking yourself for not having moved early enough to lock in the early bird price, don't worry, you can still lock in the last chance to save price before tickets go up to full price there. Just a reminder too, that if you are a premium subscriber to our Substack, you will receive $50 off in addition to the last chance to save price. So make sure that if you're a premium subscriber, you enter in the code that we've emailed you, or if you're not one yet, become one now and enjoy that $50 discount. Just go to our Substack, adamtaggart.substack.com. It's only 15 bucks a month. I'm totally happy if you sign up just for 1 month to save the $15, to pay the $15 to save the larger $50 and pocket the $35 in savings. I want you to get the lowest price possible for this. All right, Mike, as we're wrapping up here, well, first off, again, before I hand you the football, I just want to remind folks, because Gordon already made my pitch for this, but if you are a regular investor just trying to figure out how to navigate the future that lies ahead, you know, everything that Gordon laid out there, everything that John and Mike have been talking about here, if you're feeling a bit vulnerable, a bit underprepared to be the captain of your financial ship through all that, again, highly recommend, as Gordon said, that you work under the guidance of a good, experienced financial advisor who takes into account all the macro issues that Gordon and I talked about. If you've got a good one who's doing that for you and then executing it in real time for you and reacting to, you know, changes on the ground and certainly prepared to react to whatever rule book changes might come flying our way, great, stick with them. Those advisors are extremely rare. But if you don't have one, or if you'd like a second opinion from one who does, maybe even John and Mike and their team there at New Harbor Financial, then fill out the short form at thoughtfulmoney.com to schedule a free consultation with these advisors. These are the guys that you see on this program with me week after week. These consultations are totally free. They are no commitment. There's no strings attached. It's just a free public service that these financial advisors that I've recruited to this program provide to help as many people as possible position as prudently as possible for today for what's likely coming down the pike. All right, with that, Mike, I'll hand you the torch here for the final word.
All right, Adam, very quickly, I'd like to share one more chart and then just a closing comment. I'll try to be as fast as I can. So the chart that I haven't shared in a few weeks is that of gold. Can you see the chart now?
I do.
All right, so this is gold. It's, I believe, the biggest base I can find anywhere in any security. I'm sure there's others that look better than this, but this one looks the best to me. Anything that out of anything I can see. This chart goes back 20 years. Over the last 12, 13 years since the 2011 top, gold has formed this giant base. This is called a cup. This would be a handle over here. It's kind of complex and longer than that than normal. Gold has kind of carved out this channel over the last 1, 2, 3, 4, going on 5 years now. And so we're sitting right at the top. This is a monthly chart. Take a look here. Today is the last day of the month. We're filming this on February 29th. This is what's called an up hammer. You know, it's a bullish monthly candle for what it's worth. It doesn't really mean much in itself. It's the overall structure that's bullish. We've got 1, 2, 3 tops. Triple tops don't usually hold in markets. This asset has carved out the biggest base I've seen in my professional career. And it's my opinion that this is going to break out and move higher. When we get a close or a couple closes above 2,100, I believe gold is going to move higher towards 2,500. It's why we think that people should have some. It's a good investment. It's a good hedge. For those that don't have gold, consider 5 to 10% of your investable assets. Gold miners, we readily admit, have been lagging. We're a bit puzzled by it too. There's a lot of arguments as to why mining shares have lagged so badly relative to gold. All I can say is that we have lived through or seen periods like this for 10 to 15 years where gold miners have underperformed, and we're sitting at historic underperformance levels. Some say it's because of regulation. Others say it's because of energy costs. Others say it's because of bad management. All of the above can be true and probably are to some extent, but a lot of that's baked in, and mining shares are trading at really severe undervaluation levels. And if we get this breakout higher, I think the market will wake up and the miners will at least to some extent play some catch up. So our mining positions are hedged to some extent. We've got 50% of them hedged right about where mining shares are now. And so we're just holding on and helping our clients hold on through that ride. So let me stop sharing. The last thing I'd say is, you know, this is a bigger deal than you think. If Gordon talks about how we're likely in a grand super cycle situation. He mentioned Elliott Wave, something that we're familiar with as well. To some people, it's hocus pocus, and it's certainly not the only thing we look at, but it's one of many things we look at. We consider the fourth turning and the fact that we're probably in the closing years of a fourth turning. We look at math and charts and realize that we've never seen these numbers before in any of our lifetimes. It's a bigger deal than you think. And all of this is to try to balance the world, or, you know, balance everything on a pin, kind of like in a Chinese acrobat show where everything's spinning and you don't want anything to fall and it won't break. And so far the Fed has been able to keep all the plates spinning, right? But we don't want to scare people, and Gordon doesn't either. It's going to be fine. There's going to be opportunities. The first turning is going to be great, but don't feel the need to emotionally be in this. You know, talk to us, talk to a professional, or just get the heck out and sit in 5% treasury bills for a while. And so that's how I'd like to close. Thanks, Adam.
All right. Well said there, Mike. All right. Well, gents, thanks so much for joining me for yet another week. Whatever happens in the ensuing week, we'll have you guys back on next week to make sense of it for folks here. Everybody else, this was a long one. Thanks so much for hanging with us. See you next time.
See you next time.
Till next week, Adam. Thanks.